There was a muffled rustling on the line that sounded like she was holding the phone against her chest as she spoke to whoever was in the car. A doctor came through the double doors and scrubs, head down, looking very serious. He headed right for Charlie, who dropped his phone in his lap. Jane and Cassie parked in the emergency-only lane at the hospital. Jane stayed with the car while Cassie snuck into the waiting room to retrieve the sleeping Sophie, who hung in her arms like a snoring rag doll. Cassie emerged from the double doors just as Audrey was climbing out of Rivera's unmarked police car with a cat carrier containing Wiggly Charlie. Jane jumped out and herded Mrs. Ling down from the landing into the back seat of the car. Mrs. Ling's cart stubbornly refused to fold up, so Jane chucked Wiggly Charlie's cat carrier into the cart and fitted it into the back seat between Audrey and Mrs. Ling. The same sort of stealth fire drill happened when they were bringing Sophie back to the apartment. Jane led Audrey into Charlie's new apartment, and Cassie carried the sleeping Sophie into their apartment, leaving Mrs. Ling to fend for herself. When the elevator cleared, Mrs. Ling looked into her cart to see the cat carrier. She wheeled it to her apartment on the third floor, then unzipped the cat carrier just far enough to peek inside and smiled for the first time since her friend had fallen down. She had cooked a creature almost exactly like this one before, when one of the early squirrel people who fancied himself an assassin broke into the building only to find himself in Mrs. Ling's soup pot. Duck in pants, she had called the dish. This one would make a nice soup that she could take to Mrs. Korjev at the hospital. She went to the kitchen and filled her blackened soup pot with water and turned on the flame. "Need a cheese," said Wiggly Charlie from his carrier. Rivera slammed 2 5-hour energy drinks as an act of faith. Not the faith of his father, which he now looked upon as quaint ritual, but faith in his own anger, because if he looked at the situation rationally, 5 hours was probably 4.5 hours longer than his current life expectancy. He was exhausted, having driven all over town through most of the night, doing what he had come to think of as the to-do list of the dead. But now dawn was breaking, and he and Minty Fresh were pulling into the concrete channel where the old train tracks cut into the knoll at Fort Mason. "Back in," said Minty Fresh. Rivera flipped a Y turn and backed the brown Ford into the channel until they were about 25 yards from the big steel doors that led into the tunnel, then stopped, popped the trunk, and got out. Minty Fresh unfolded out of his side of the car and met Rivera at the back. Minty in green leather trousers and black trainers, Rivera in his oversized sport coat, jeans, and black nylon tactical boots. Rivera pulled 2 folding, men-working barricades out of the trunk and handed one to Minty Fresh. They set them up in front of the car and turned on the flashers. "I told dispatch that animal control was going to be using some charges to chase rats and ground squirrels out of the tunnel, so if they get any calls for people hearing gunfire, they have an explanation."
"They believe that?"
"They love having an answer." They walked back to the trunk.
"You got bolt cutters?"
asked Minty Fresh, shooting a glance over his shoulder toward the steel doors.
"Yeah, but I think we can probably climb over. They're what, 8 feet tall? I'm not that old. I ain't worried about getting in, but if shit goes sideways, I sure don't want to have to get over those motherfuckers in a hurry getting out."
Rivera ticked off a point well made in the air, pulled the bolt cutters from the trunk, and leaned them against the bumper. He handed Minty Fresh a light flak vest.
"Blade resistant," he said. "Prison guards wear them. Should fit, just may not cover you all the way down."
Minty Fresh shrugged off his leather coat and the double shoulder holster with the massive Desert Eagle pistols. He put on the vest.
"Turn," Rivera said. "Lift your arms."
The mint one did as instructed, and Rivera cinched the vest up tight on him. Minty put on his shoulder holsters, buckled them down, then his coat. Rivera held up a riot helmet.
"I guessed at the size."
Minty Fresh looked at the helmet like it was a foul, dead thing.
"Yeah, I ain't wearing that. It's Kevlar, lights, and goggles. You said one of them flings venom from her claws."
Minty Fresh pulled a pair of wraparound sunglasses from the breast pocket of his coat, flicked them open, and put them on.
"Gonna be dark in there." I have excellent night vision.
Suit yourself, said Rivera. He put on his own helmet and pulled down the goggles. Rivera handed Minty some orange foam earplugs.
You're gonna want these. I'll be all right.
Rivera grinned, looking, in all the tactical gear, like a victorious soldier in the tooth-whitening wars. He reached into the trunk and pulled back the flap on a nylon satchel, revealing a row of grenades clipped into elastic straps.
Flashbangs! Trust me, you're gonna want earplugs.
Minty smiled.
We gonna throw grenades in the park and 911 gonna tell people we're animal control? Aren't we?
Minty held out his palm, and Rivera dropped the earplugs. Rivera handed him a riot shotgun with a pistol grip, a laser sight on the top, and a flashlight slung under the barrel.
You ever use one of these?
I have.
Semi-automatic. Just click off the safety and pull the trigger. I have double-aught buckshot in them. They'll tear the hell out of whatever they hit. But they're not magnum loads, so they'll kick less. And if you have to shoot quickly, you'll still be able to aim. You have 9 shots, with 1 in the chamber, 5 each extra on the elastic on the stock, 4 on the forestock.
He pulled a box of shells from the trunk.
You want some extras for your jacket pocket?
Minty Fresh laughed.
No, Inspector. I think 18 shots in our handguns are either gonna do the trick or we gonna get done.
Rivera nodded and shrugged off his sport coat, revealing the Beretta slunged in a shoulder holster under his left arm, 2 extra clips under his right. He was checking for the 10th time that each was loaded when he heard gravel crunching and a silver-blue Honda pulled up in front of his Ford. He checked his watch.
I thought you told him 7. It's barely 6:15.
I did, said Fresh.
Charlie Asher climbed out of Audrey's Honda and stood by the door.
You guys are ready already? He wore a leather jacket and was carrying a black cane with a silver handle, but otherwise he looked like Mike Sullivan out to buy a paper.
How's the old lady? Asked Rivera.
She's stable, heart attack, her son is there.
But alive,
said Rivera. He looked at Minty Fresh.
That's good, said Minty. Meaning more than it was good that she was alive.
It was good that Lemon had attacked her, and she'd managed to survive it. It meant Lemon was vulnerable.
Where's the Emperor? Charlie asked.
Jail, said Rivera.
Really?
Just until this is over.
Actually, I had them lock him in a cage at the animal shelter so his men could stay with them. They owed me a favor.
Charlie joined them at the back of the Ford. My motocross leathers got all cut up when Mike jumped off the bridge, so I only have this jacket. Should be okay, right?
Yeah, you ain't gonna need them, said Minty Fresh.
Go home to your daughter, Charlie, Rivera said.
What are you talking about? This is my battle. I'm not afraid of them. I've done this before.
We know, said Rivera. That's not even the issue. You have to go back to Audrey and your daughter and your sister, because you have them to go back to.
We don't, said Minty Fresh.
I have guns now. Look at these bad boys, Charlie said, flexing his biceps. I didn't have these before.
Have you ever been to the animal shelter, Charlie? Rivera said.
I could show you around.
Go home, Charlie, said Minty Fresh. I didn't go to all that trouble to bring you back to life so you could get killed again. If something happened to me, you look out for Lily, you hear?
You know I will. Charlie slumped, knowing he was defeated. They had decided this long before now. If he hadn't shown up early, it would all be over by now. And they had a point. He had charged into battle against the Morgan once before, and Sophie had lost her daddy for a year. He couldn't do that to her again.
Well, at least take this with you. Charlie held out the cane.
It's my sword cane.
We look like we need more weapons?
It was my soul vessel. Where my soul went before Audrey put it into that little body. It might be good luck or something.
Didn't you have this with you when you got killed? The mint one asked.
Kind of. Minty took the cane from him and tucked it into his belt.
Thank you.
Give a brother a pound. Charlie held out his fist to receive a pound. The mint one left him hanging.
Don't do that, said Minty.
Sorry.
Charlie turned to Rivera, started to go in for a hug, which Rivera intercepted and turned into a handshake.
"Something happens, you can have my suits," he said.
"Nothing's going to happen," said Charlie. Rivera smiled.
"If you're going to stay out here, tell anyone who comes up that we're animal control and they should move along because of the chemicals."
"What chemicals?"
"The dangerous imaginary ones," he said.
Rivera looked to Minty Fresh.
"You ready?"
Rivera started for the doors. Minty Fresh followed, the bolt cutters in one hand, the shotgun in the other. Minty Fresh said,
"Are you absolutely sure you want to do this? Seems like maybe it would make more sense to call in a SWAT team or Special Forces."
"That won't work. Isn't Special Forces where everyone gets a hug?" Charlie called.
"That's the Special Olympics," Rivera said over his shoulder.
To Minty, he said,
"How are you going to explain this, the Morrigan?"
"Just so we're clear then," said the Mint One. "We're only doing this because we want to avoid an awkward explanation to other police, right?"
Rivera paused.
"No, we're doing this because they murdered my partner, and I don't think they're going to come along quietly if I try to arrest them. They're going to come for us eventually, and if we wait, it will be on their terms. Now is better."
"You don't never be lying," said Minty Fresh.
He stopped at the doors and leaned the shotgun against the concrete wall.
"Do you smell something burning?"
"Oh, hell," said Rivera. He cringed and braced himself.
"Aye!"
called the Banshee. Minty Fresh dropped the bolt cutters, snatched up his shotgun, and brought the sight down on the sooty wraith.
"Don't shoot her! Don't shoot her! Don't shoot her!"
Rivera stepped away from the Banshee and pushed down the barrel of Minty Fresh's shotgun.
"What do you think you're doing, you ninny?" said the Banshee. "You can't go in there."
"We have to," said Rivera.
"I tried to warn your great fat friend, and you know how that turned out. And the harpies are even stronger now than they were then."
"I know. Thank you," said Rivera. "But we have to do this."
"Fine. I'll naysay at your funeral, you bloody loony."
The stun gun crackled in the air, and she was gone.
"She thinks it's a box of lightning," Rivera explained. "She thinks it adds drama to her entrances and exits."
"Right, 'cause what the bitch needs is more drama."
Because the Morrigan were goddesses of war, they were attracted to the sound of war drums. So when they first rose in the modern world, a pocket of the underworld opened under the rumbling boom they followed. As it turned out, they had entered the world under a bowling alley, and it was there that they absorbed the dialect of English that they now spoke.
"This sucks," said Babbed. "I don't know why we have to stay down here now."
She was reclining in the bucket of a skip loader, methodically licking the last remnants of some squirrel person from her claws. They were all strong and lithe, and they shimmered in the dim light of the tunnel like swaths of starry night. Macha leaned against the tunnel wall and preened her breast with her claws, retracted to the length of a cat's claw.
"We can go into the light," said Nemain,
who was crouched over a wolf spider, dripping venom from her talon as the creature tried to escape, then blocking its path with another sizzling drop as it bolted the other way.
"What does Yama know?"
They had flown in their raven forms to the tunnel while it was still dark, bloated with the power of new souls, moving again as shadows was beyond them, at least for a while.
"We could find the rest of the soul stealers," said Babbed. "Take their souls! Kill them!" "Yama says if we go into the light, we'll attract the attention of humans," said Nemain. "I thought that was the point," said Macha. "Have our names on their breath as they die. Have them cower when a raven passes over them." "Why can't we just kill everybody?" said Babbed, pouting.
An inhuman shriek sounded from the far end of the tunnel. Nemain impaled the spider she'd been torturing with her talon and stood.
"Did you hear that?"
Babbed climbed out of the skip loader basket, looked down the tunnel around the column of heavy machinery.
"There's too much light. Someone's moving down there."
"Snacks,"
said Macha, grinning in anticipation, her fangs showing against her lower lip. Something clattered against the wall on Macha's left and fell at her feet. It looked like a green soup can. Another object rattled and bounced down the other side of the tractor and settled a few feet from Babbed. The flashbangs exploded. Deafening concussion. Blinding light. Babbed was thrown back into the bucket of the skip loader. Maja staggered, spun, bouncing off the wall, her arms up by her ears as she willed them not to turn into wings, to flee. Not in a tunnel. Babbed shrieked, her most ferocious battle cry, the call that had made warriors soil themselves and cower in terror on the battlefield as their enemies harvested their heads. She was answered with a flash and a shot, and her left arm was shredded. Another shot, her foot blown out from under her. "You fuckers!" Her scream resonated in the metal of the machines. On the opposite side of the tunnel, Maja fell into a crouch, having deduced where the attack was coming from. A light and a red dot panned up the side of the tunnel, settled on her as she dove, and the projectiles took her full in the side, rolling her over in the air to land against the bucket of the skip loader. The main fell between the unused train tracks. Light and lasers and explosive fire were blazing down either side of the tractor in front of her. She watched as parts of her sisters were shaken and shredded with impact. Flares smelling of sulfur came bouncing down the tunnel and projected shadows of her sisters' torment across the ceiling. She scuttled forward under the tractor, rolled onto her back, pulled herself up onto the drive shaft, and hung there, perhaps a foot off the ground, as the conflagration raged on either side of her. Fear was foreign to her. In 1,000 years on and over the battlefields of the North, she'd never had to defend herself. It was war. Someone was going to die, and she was death. It had always been win-win. The roar of gunfire paused. Human footfalls, the hiss of the burning flares, a mechanical clicking noise, light beams bouncing in the sulfur smoke.
"Anything?" A man's voice.
"Something on my side headed away, further down the tunnel."
"One here, too."
"The tunnel is walled up at the other end, heavy wooden slats into Fort Mason parking lot. Reloading." Click, click, click.
Then she saw them, human legs moving up the tunnel. One man on either side of her, the one on her right closer. Take down one, and then make a dash after Maja and Babbed. The one on the right, then, in the green leather. She unsheathed her claws on that side to their full length. Venom dripped and softly sizzled on a steel rail below. Minty Fresh was trying to keep the light on the shotgun pointed down the tunnel as he pushed fresh shells into the tubular magazine, which made his grip on the gun precarious at best. When the Morrigan's claws struck his calf, he lost his grip on the shotgun and fumbled it away, the light bouncing around the tunnel like an epileptic Tinkerbell. He pulled away from the pain, and his feet were yanked out from under him. He landed hard on his side, his breath knocked out, and he felt himself being yanked under the tractor. With one hand, he caught a piece of metal that protruded from the front wheel of the tractor, a steering bar, perhaps, while he swung a fist at his attacker, hitting nothing. Rivera shouting, white pain in his leg, frantic digging in his coat with his free hand for one of the Desert Eagles. He touched one, was yanked, lost orientation, reached again. His free hand whipped around, settled on something round. At first he thought another piece of the tractor, but it was Charlie Asher's sword cane. He pulled it free from the scabbard and swung in the direction of his attacker as hard as he could. A screech, not Rivera. The grip on his calf gone. He fell slack on the train tracks. A shotgun firing, a figure, illuminated by the highway flares, rolling out from under the tractor, awkwardly scrambling to her feet. Another shotgun blast, and she was spun around, fell, and scuttled off into the dark, screeching.
"You okay?"
asked Rivera, his face appearing by a wheel on the opposite side of the tractor.
"Yeah, the fuck!"
Now on the ground by his leg, he saw the severed claw of the Morrigan twitching, evaporating into a feathery vapor spewing from the severed wrist until, in a few seconds, it was gone.
"She got my leg!"
Rivera ran around the front of the tractor, crouched beside the mint one. He pulled a flashlight out of his vest, played it over Minty Fresh, set it on the ground, pointing at his leg. The blood looked like tar. Rivera took off his belt and wrapped it around Minty's leg just above the knee, tightened it down, putting his foot on it for the tension.
"Hold this tight!" He handed the free end of the belt to Minty Fresh.
"Go get them!" Fresh said.
Rivera shook his head, dug his phone out of his jacket pocket, checked the signal.
"Fuck, I'm gonna have to go back out to get a signal and call help."
Rivera helped Minty Fresh sit up against the tractor wheel, then took the end of his belt from the big man and tied it off. He picked up his own shotgun and handed it to Minty.
"Two still in it. The extra's still on the stock."
"Yeah, reloading might have been my mistake," said Minty.
"I'll be back."
Rivera picked up his flashlight and stood. As soon as the light played back toward the entrance, he saw the new, fitter Charlie Asher coming out of the darkness.
"A really scary-looking woman in black rags told me you guys might need help," Charlie said.
"Grab an arm," Rivera said. "We need to get him out of here."
He looked down to see that Minty Fresh was unconscious. Chapter 25. The Death Card. Charlie hadn't told Audrey he was going to attack the Morrigan. He hadn't told her anyone was going to attack the Morrigan. The last she had heard about it, the attack was theoretical. Inspector Rivera blowing off steam, she thought. Charlie had taken a taxi home from the hospital after Mrs. Korjav's son had arrived from Los Angeles and let himself into the new apartment, which still smelled of paint and cleaning products. He crawled into bed with Audrey and kissed her awake enough to tell her that Mrs. Korjav was stable, and for her to tell him that Sophie was sleeping in her own bed in the other apartment, but she hadn't told him anything else. They made love, and she flinched once when he brushed against her ankle, which was raw from where she'd been duct-taped by the squirrel people. But she'd passed the movement off as passion, and she fell asleep in his arms, feeling safe for the first time in days. She had awakened when he rose at dawn, went right back to sleep when he kissed her on the temple, and crept out of the apartment, leaving a note on the breakfast bar that said, "Had to go out, we'll call you in a couple of hours. Tell Sophie I love her. Love, Charlie." Not going to engage the powers of darkness, because that worked out so well last time. Not, I'm a complete moron with no common sense and no consideration for the people who love me. No, just had to go out. So when he called her around 7 and said he was headed to San Francisco General Hospital because that's where the ambulance was taking Minty Fresh and he would pick her up outside in 5 minutes, well, she'd been a bit surprised and a little angry. When he pulled up out front in her Honda and she crawled in, she really wanted to shout at him. Hug him first, then maybe hit him a bunch of times, which caused her years of training to kick in. And instead, she took a long, slow breath and let it out over a count of 10. One did not become the caretaker for the forgotten chapters of the Book of Living and Dying by indulging in random freakouts every time one encountered difficulty. So she only hit him once.
"Ouch! What was that for? Why didn't you tell me what you were doing?"
"I didn't want you to worry." She let that sit for a while. Were her reasons for not telling him about the massacre at the Buddhist Center any more pure? Wasn't she just trying to keep him from being distressed? She had done so much wrong, with good intentions, but wrong nonetheless. She had done the right thing, not the easy thing, by not telling him. Probably, maybe. The man in yellow wasn't like the other creatures. He might be dark, he might be of darkness, but wasn't darkness necessary? Light, dark, male, female, yin, yang, balance. He'd convinced her as much after saving her from the Morrigan. He'd righted an unbroken chair and pulled it over to where she lay, bound on the floor. The remnants of shredded squirrel people littered the room.
"Do you mind if I sit?" he asked. The absurdity of him asking her approval when she was trussed up on the carpet almost made her laugh.
"Please," she said. He tipped his hat, as if spilling silky sax notes off the brim, then took 5 shuffling steps to get around from the back of the chair to the front. Shaking a leg on every other step, he sat, leaned forward.
"How you doing?" he said.
He had a gold crown on an upper right bicuspid, and he showed it to her with a smile. I'm tied up on the floor, and I've almost been murdered twice in 5 minutes.
Well, the night is young, he said, a little too much cheer in his voice.
She took a deep breath, let it out while reciting a Sanskrit chant in her mind. Right now, in this instant, she was fine. He laughed.
I'm just fucking with you. Ain't nobody gonna hurt you, Red. You mind if I call you Red? That whole venerable Rinpoche jazz a bit of a mouthful.
Strictly speaking, her hair wasn't red, but auburn. But she nodded approval anyway.
And you are Death?
That really more a title than a name. You probably wanna gonna call me Yama.
Yama?
She thought she'd been as surprised as she could be tonight. Apparently not.
Protector of Buddhism?
That's right. But we not using titles, right? Now, Red, I cut you loose. You not gonna freak out and go all kung fu and shit on me, are you?
I'll make tea, she said.
He laughed, pulled a straight razor from his jacket pocket, and leaned over.
Hold still now.
He cut the tape on her wrists, then handed her the razor so she could do her ankles herself. The handle of the razor was ivory or bone, yellowed with age. She cut the tape, then folded the razor and handed it back to him, careful not to step in anyone. She braced herself and ripped the remaining tape off her ankles and wrists. He cringed at the sound, in sympathy with her pain.
You got somewhere else we can chat? Disorder in here, harsh in my mellow.
She led him through the dining room into the kitchen.
Your minions made that mess. Those were human souls.
She wasn't afraid of him. She had come face to face with Death 3 times tonight already, including him, and she was unafraid.
Well, that is true, he said, pulling out a chair at the oak table. But they weren't the ones put them human souls in those little monsters now, were they? They freed those souls to their natural course. Their methods can be rough, but they do get the job done. Truth told, they ain't my minions, but I do admire a strong black woman.
They slaughtered them, Audrey said.
Slaughtered who, Red? The latest can't take a soul from a human. Might have been a time back in the day, but not now. Them things you made weren't people. They was prisons. The ladies just busted them out.
She was more shaken by that than by all the violence of the night. She had been wrong. Her intentions might have been pure, but her actions had not been. Had the Morrigan really freed the souls of the squirrel people? She had seen them grow more solid, stronger, with each soul they devoured. She put on the kettle and went about the homey ritual of making tea. The fire on, she turned her back to the counter to face him.
You're right. Why didn't you let them kill me?
Lemon looked around as if someone might be listening.
They no need for that. That's not why I'm here.
They killed Inspector Cavuto.
Not my intention. You know how things get out of hand. They got out of hand that night. They was a long time down. They get a little drunk with being up here.
So they're not here to bring up the darkness? To cover the world and reign for 1,000 years? Like they said before?
Before? You mean when they with Orcus? That dumb motherfucker? Fuck no. That ain't what I'm doing here. You tell soldiers what they need to hear to go to war. Bitches need a mission, not a goal. It's my war.
War on who?
He shrugged.
Not for me to say. I'm just filling a need, putting things in order. Ain't no sides. Death don't discriminate. I don't judge. I don't deny anyone. I don't shun anybody. I accept everyone. Death be not proud, Red.
He shot his lapels, grinned.
Death be chic, baby, but not proud. I am loving kindness. You think you know what life worth more than me? I speed these souls on to become one with all things. Y'all fuck things up. Y'all and all these motherfuckers selling souls in this city. You know that, Red? What you think call me up after 1,000 years? This ain't your first barbecue. You think this through.
you'll see I ain't the one knocking things out of order. I'm the one putting them back. Y'all just need to stay out of my way.
Okay, she said. There was a truth to what he said, a logic. The universe sought balance, and the universe oscillated. And when it oscillated, between the beats of the heart of the universe, there rose the agent of change, chaos. Chaos sat at her table.
What kind of tea would you like?
You got any decaf? Caffeine makes me jumpy.
Decaf green or decaf cinnamon spice?
Cinnamon spice sound nice.
So, you're the ghost thief.
Thought we wasn't using titles.
Why did you move the souls to the bridge then?
The bridge? Yeah, the bridge. Well, you know, seems like a good place for safekeeping.
She had believed him then, believed that he was putting things in order. But now, after finding out about Mrs. Korchev's heart attack, which Sophie insisted had been brought on by the man in yellow, after Minty Fresh had fallen under the Morrigan, well, Yama hadn't really explained why he couldn't control the Morrigan. He hadn't explained why establishing his new order involved so much destruction, and for some reason, she hadn't questioned him. She'd felt strangely calm after talking to him, drinking tea at the kitchen table, at peace. But now, not so much. Charlie parked in one of the hospital garages, and they spent 20 minutes asking people where they might find a Mr. Fresh before Charlie's phone buzzed with a text from Rivera directing them to intensive care. Rivera had shed his tactical gear, but was still wearing the ill-fitting sport coat.
I tried to talk the doctor into giving him some anti-venom, but he wanted to know the species of snake.
Did you tell him big? Charlie said.
Yeah, he wanted more than big. He probably passed out from blood loss or shock rather than the venom. The wound wasn't as deep as we thought, but it nicked an artery. Luckily, we got a tourniquet on him right away. He should be sewed up by now.
Did someone call Lily? Audrey asked. Would you? Her number's in my contacts. Charlie handed her his phone, and Audrey stepped outside of the waiting room. As soon as Audrey was out of earshot, Rivera said,
I went back in.
What? Alone? Charlie trying to whisper, but it was coming out louder than if he were talking in a normal voice. The few people sitting in the lobby looked up.
They were gone. I went all the way to the other side of the tunnel. It's closed off.
Do you think they are just gone like before? Charlie said. Like when Sophie did whatever she did? Atomize them, I guess?
I don't think so. Certainly the one that clawed Fresh wasn't hurt very badly. We hit the other ones hard, though. I saw what happened, but they were really strong, a lot more than one I shot in the alley when, you know.
I was mesmerized by her or something, said Charlie, still embarrassed about the time he had let the Morrigan give a handjob in an alley off Broadway, and Rivera had delivered 9 rounds of life-saving 9mm cock block. And sad. I was weak and sad.
Doesn't matter, Charlie. What I'm saying is that they got out of the tunnel somehow, and there's no way out except the entrance we came in. Not even a maintenance passageway, like in the bot tunnels. And they didn't get by me.
Did you check for drainage grates? You know, they were sliding in and out of the storm sewers. They don't need much space when they're...
There's a Buick in the tunnel, Rivera said. A big old yellow Buick, all the way at the Fort Mason end, which is boarded up with 4-inch-thick beams, so either this man in yellow moved 20 pieces of heavy equipment out of the tunnel, parked his car, then moved 20 pieces back in, or he has another way of getting in and out of that tunnel, a way I can't see.
Audrey came back through the glass double doors and joined them. Her mom is bringing her over now. Oh, good, she's not alone, Charlie said. Lily's mom is nice, kind of surprisingly.
You're dead to her. Audrey said.
Why? What did I do to her?
No, I mean, you need to remember that Charlie Asher is dead to her. She's not going to recognize you in this body.
Oh, yeah, right. A nurse came in from the ward side of the waiting room, and everyone looked up. She headed right for Rivera.
Inspector, he's awake and asking for you. She looked apologetically at Audrey and Charlie. I can only let the inspector in, or family. I'm sorry.
We're family, Charlie said. The nurse looked at him, then at Audrey,
and seemed as if she was trying to think of exactly how to answer without seeming horrible and racist, when Rivera said, "They are part of this investigation. I didn't want to tell the doctor, but this was an assault. Mr. Sullivan is a herpetologist, and Ms. Rinpoche is a sketch artist." The nurse appeared almost relieved, but did look for Audrey's sketch pad. Audrey held up Charlie's smartphone. "All digital now." "We gave him something for the pain," said the nurse, as the nurse led them into Minty's room, which was behind a glass wall facing the nurse's desk. Audrey whispered, "My last name isn't Rinpoche. That's a title."
"You're not a sketch artist either, are you?" Rivera whispered back. "I couldn't remember your last name."
Minty Fresh's injured leg was bandaged and held in traction, so his knee was at a right angle. His hospital bed was propped up about 30 degrees, and his other leg jutted a foot and a half out into space. He smiled when they came in. His face was starting to go gray.
"This is some bullshit," said the mint one. "I'm gonna die and my foot is cold."
Audrey tried to adjust his blanket, but with the one leg propped up, she couldn't make it work without uncovering him to the waist. She whipped off her sweater and wrapped it around his foot. "Until I can get the nurse to bring you another blanket."
"Thanks," said the big man. "How you doing?" said Charlie. "How was you doing when this happened to you?"
Minty looked to Audrey.
"Don't you put me in one of those creepy puppet things like you did him. Just let me go, you hear?"
"Oh, I'm so sorry," Audrey said. She hugged his jutting foot. "I didn't know. I would have warned you. I watched them get strong, so strong, with each of the squirrel people they killed. It was so horrible. I didn't know you were going to go after them. I didn't know."
"What are you talking about?"
So she told them about the attack on the Buddhist Center, about how the Morrigan had grown, taken form as they slaughtered the squirrel people. She told them about Yama releasing her, saving her from the Morrigan, and what he had said about trying to establish the new order.
"He just let you go?" Charlie said. "Who the fuck Yama?" said Minty.
"The man in yellow," said Audrey. "He's a Buddhist personification of death. The legend was that he was a monk who was told if he meditated for 50 years, he would achieve enlightenment. So he went into a cave in the mountains, and he meditated for 49 years, 364 days. And on the last day, some thieves came into the cave, leading a bull they had stolen, and they decapitated it. And when he asked to be spared, they decapitated him, too. He was reincarnated as Yama, a powerful demon god, and he put the head of the bull on his own body, and then killed the thieves and became the prime ruler over death. The protector of Buddhism. He's one of the demons we're told to ignore when we are training to lead people through Bardo, from life to death."
"Yama, huh?" Minty Fresh said.
"Yes, I'm so sorry. I should have told you all."
"That's okay. How about you let go of my leg?"
Audrey had been hugging his calf and foot through the entire Yama story. Now she was embarrassed as well as sorry.
"But you didn't ignore him, right?" said Charlie.
"Honestly, I didn't really remember him until now. Does that make sense?"
"It's all right, Audrey," Minty said. "He has some kind of gree-gree he put on people. Kid that works for me was all woo-woo with it, too, asking me about where my soul vessels went. I knew something was up with him. Motherfucker been sneaky since we was little."
"Pardon?" said Charlie.
"Yama, my cousin."
"Wait," said Audrey. "What?"
"He might be Yama now, but when I knew him, his name was Lemon, and he was my cousin."
"Lemon Fresh?" asked Charlie. "So that isn't a nickname you made up?" Rivera turned aside and tried to hide his smile.
"Don't you laugh," said Minty. "Lemon was not an uncommon name in Louisiana in those days, and I'm dying here."
"He said he's just trying to establish a new order," Audrey said, even more distressed now. "And that's what we thought was happening. That's part of the cycle, part of the wheel of life and death, right?"
"Audrey," Minty Fresh said, his eyelids fluttering a bit now, "I don't want to rush y'all, but I probably got a limited time to live. So if you could just tell us..."
"I think I told him the lost souls are on the bridge," Audrey said. Minty Fresh looked from Charlie to Rivera back to Audrey.
"Was anyone going to tell me?"
"I was going to," said Charlie. but I only found out yesterday afternoon, and things have moved kind of fast since then. Were you going to tell us that the new menace to reality as we know it is your cousin?
Don't sass me, Charlie. I'm dying.
You can't keep playing the death card.
I don't want to keep playing the death card, but the death card been played. Just let me go with a little dignity.
He closed his eyes, took a gasping breath.
You mean instead of lying like a rug? Charlie said.
One of Minty Fresh's eyes popped open, his dignified death having been postponed by being called on his shit.
You know, Asher, just because you have biceps now doesn't mean you can talk to me like that.
Your cousin?
He sent me the book, all right? He made me into a death merchant 20-some years ago, then he disappeared. Only reason I knew he was in town is he's still driving that raggedy old Buick Roadmaster. I would spit, but my mouth is dry.
There was a squeeze bottle of water on the nightstand. Audrey held it for Minty Fresh to have a drink.
Wear my shades. Let me die with a touch of cool.
Rivera took Minty Fresh's sunglasses from his jacket pocket, helped fit them on the big man, then they all stood there for a minute waiting.
Anybody got any train on they phone? Asked Minty. Some miles?
Sad shaking of heads.
Figures, said Minty Fresh.
He lay back, as if he was hearing the notes. They all listened to his breathing and watched the cardiac monitor's jagged line. The nurse came through the glass door, and everyone stood a little straighter and tried to look a little more official, as if she couldn't have seen them through the glass before she came in.
Mr. Fresh?
What? What? What?
Minty Fresh said, lifting his head up.
It's so dark. Why so dark? Here I go. Here I come. Lemon, you bitch-ass motherfucker.
You have your sunglasses on, said the nurse.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Mr. Fresh, there's a young woman out here who says she's your priest.
Big titties? Dressed like a vampire?
Well, I guess, said the nurse, giving Rivera a nervous look. She's kind of dressed more like a Catholic schoolgirl.
Yeah, that, my priest. Send her in.
So, some good pain meds? Rivera said.
Fine as frog fur, said the mint one.
He offered Rivera a pound with his non-IV hand, and Rivera returned it. Charlie Asher frowned. Having never gotten a pound from the big man, he felt slighted.
Let's give them some privacy, said Audrey.
They passed Lily on the way out of the room, each giving her a pat on the shoulder. In the lobby, among the other distressed and waiting, stood a slim woman in her 40s with dark hair, wearing a sharp-knit suit with military-style gold trim. Charlie recognized her as Lily's mother. But unless you saw them both side by side without eye makeup, which was a condition in which Charlie had never seen Lily, and saw that they had the same wide, blue eyes, you'd have never guessed they were related. Charlie elbowed Rivera and whispered,
Lily's mom, Mrs. Severo.
Rivera showed 1 second of an, are you kidding me, look, then gathered his composure and introduced himself to her.
Inspector Rivera, she said, shaking his hand. I'm afraid to ask how you know my daughter.
I met her at Charlie Asher's shop when she worked there.
Charlie Asher was a good man.
He was, said Rivera.
He was good for Lily. She was a wild child. But I think her job at Charlie's store kept her grounded, at least some of the time. I work so much, it's just been Lily and me. I'm not even sure she's over Charlie's passing. Now this.
Rivera could tell she was feeling responsible for her daughter's pain, and he wanted to tell her just how much this was not her fault. He wanted to put his arm around her and to be a decent human being. But he wasn't finding it easy, because this, the attack on Minty, was murder, and he had a protocol for dealing with the loved ones of the victim. It didn't seem right.
Mr. Fresh is a good guy.
I don't know him. Never met him, of course. I worried he was older than her, but she really seems to care for him. I don't want her to be alone. It sucks to be alone.
I know, he said. I was going to offer to be here for Lily if you needed to get to work, but I'm guessing you'll be staying. Can I get you a cup of coffee?
That would be nice, Inspector.
Alphonse, he said. She nodded.
I'm Elizabeth.
Liz.
Liz, he repeated, smiled. Liz, I've known Lily since she was 16, Rivera said. You had your work cut out for you. She was a spooky kid.
Oh, you have no idea, she said.
Maybe I do. What are you taking your coffee?
He was about to head back out of the glass doors, into the hallway, when he saw a familiar doctor walk up to the nurse's desk, confer with the attending nurse, then look around until he caught Rivera's eye. Rivera intercepted him at the desk. Dr. Hathaway, Rivera reminded himself.
How are you doing, Inspector?
Asked the doctor.
That depends, said Rivera.
I don't think there's anything we can do for him.
We were going to move him to a quiet room where everyone could be with him. But honestly, I don't think there's time. His organs are shutting down, and I'm surprised he's even conscious. So if you need to ask him anything, I'd do it right now.
Actually, he's a friend.
I'm sorry.
It's okay, doctor.
Code blue, doctor, called the nurse. She ran around the desk and into the room where Minty lay. Without a word, the doctor turned and followed her in. Lily came stumbling out of the glass doors, makeup blackened, tears running down her face.
Chapter 26. The Underworld. Under the San Francisco Bay, in a maintenance storage room just off a BART service tunnel, the Morgan pooled among the heavy track repair and debris clearing tools. Every few minutes, a train would go through the tunnel, and they would dig what was left of their claws into the concrete to keep from being sucked out into the greater train tunnel.
"Close the door," said Babbed. "And that won't keep happening."
It was almost completely dark in the room, and their eyes looked like silver disks floating in ink.
"I can't close the door," said Nemain. "It's big and rusty, and I can't pull it loose. I only have one hand. We should go back through the sewers to that house with all the little soul puppets," said Macha. "Get our strength back. We could get the ones that escaped under the house, where we couldn't fit." "Well, we could fit now," said Babbed.
She, like her sisters, had barely any dimension now. Even her shadow form showed holes and tears from buckshot. Nemain, who was the most solid of the three, had lost a hand, and as much as she stared at it and cursed at it, it wouldn't grow back, even in a shadow form.
"We should go someplace where there are no guns." "Or cars," said Babbed. "Or Yama." "Why is it," said Macha, "that every time we become strong enough to do something about Yama, someone shoots us up?" "I feel used," said Babbed. "Do you feel used? I don't know why we need him." "I say we go eat the soul puppets, then flay Yama right away," said Nemain. "Take his head," said Macha, who was always keen on taking heads, it being her specialty. "I'm in," said Babbed. "Let's go."
"Ladies," came a deep voice out of the dark, which was strange because they could all see in the dark and they couldn't see where the voice was coming from. "Ladies," said Lemon. Now he stood there, a palm out, an open flame burning on his palm, illuminating the room. "What are you doing in this shithole?"
"They came into the other place with guns, blowed us up," said Macha. "Look at us," said Nemain. "Don't look at us," said Babbed. "We need to go get the rest of the soul puppets, the ones that taste like ham."
"No, we not going back there, ladies. But I know a place where you can scoop souls out of the air like eating cotton candy. Thousands of them. Y'all ain't seen nothing like it."
Nemain, "Don't look at us," said Babbed. "We need to go get the rest of the soul puppets, the ones that taste like ham."
"No, we not going back there, ladies. But I know a place where you can scoop souls out of the air like eating cotton candy. Thousands of them. Y'all ain't seen nothing like it. Why, I bet once you done there, you be able to rip souls right out of a human like the old days. Ain't no gun or car can hurt you then."
"Where?" asked Macha.
"Why, when y'all are done, you'll probably be able to bring the underworld up anywhere y'all want. Maybe everywhere."
Where? Asked Nemain. "What's cotton candy?" asked Babbed,
who was the dimmest in a triad of very dark creatures.
"Well, I'll show y'all," said Lemon. but we're going to have to wait until it's dark out. There's a lot of open ground to cover to get there.
Open a door into that place, said Macha.
I'll get you all close, but you can't just wade in and scoop them all up. You nibble round the edges, maybe, and before anyone know what happened, there's one soul in particular you gotta shred. You don't get that one, you lose the rest.
Take us there, said Namain.
In the days when the underworld was in flux with the light, and gods rose and fell like mushrooms in a damp forest, there came into being two brothers, Osiris and Set. Osiris, with his queen Isis, rose to reign over the kingdom of light, and Set ruled over the dark, the underworld, with his queen Nephthys, who was fine. Set was jealous of his brother's land and worshippers, and plotted against him, while Osiris, radiant and self-assured, yearned for a taste of the dark world in Nephthys, and so he did tap that ass. From that union came a son, the dark, dog-headed god Anubis, as well as his jackal-headed brother Upawat, who would be put in a basket and set adrift in the sea to make his way unguided in a new land. But his is another story. When Set learned of his wife's affair, he murdered Osiris, and to assure that Osiris would never be reincarnated, Set cut the body into pieces and hid the pieces among the darkest, most distant corners of the underworld. Isis was overcome with grief and searched in vain for her beloved. But the dutiful dog-headed god Anubis, Osiris's son in the underworld, found the pieces of his father's body and returned them to Isis. Anubis mummified his father's body, and Isis raised his spirit to rule over the people of the sun. For his service, Anubis was given the realm of the dead in the underworld, and it was his lot to see that order was kept and justice done to the passing souls of man. Set was left to seethe with jealousy and wait for chaos to come about, and with it, his opportunity to rise again to power over the kingdoms of light and darkness. In the waiting area, Lily sobbed in her mother's arms while Rivera, Charlie, and Audrey stood by feeling helpless. Audrey squeezed Charlie's hand until it hurt, but he was actually grateful for the pain because it took his mind off of everything else. Rivera stood aside, observing, until Lily's mom looked over her daughter's shoulder at him. He recognized the same helplessness in her eyes that he'd seen in the families of so many murder victims, and he touched her back, lightly, and for only a second to let her know he was there, another human being, backup. The medical crash team had pulled curtains across the glass in Minty Fresh's room, but after 22 minutes, the curtain whooshed aside, and the doctor came through, paused a second at the desk, then turned to come through the double doors into the waiting room, the look on his face broadcasting what he was going to say. There was nothing we could do. Before the doctor reached them, Charlie felt himself go lightheaded. His vision tunneled down, went black, and he collapsed. The doctor helped Audrey catch him and lower him into a chair.
Asha, what the fuck you doing here? Said Minty Fresh.
Charlie looked around, saw literally nothing but the big man, standing perhaps 10 feet away from him, wearing only a bedsheet.
Where's here? Asked Charlie.
The mint one adjusted his sheet, which was too small for a man his size to wear as a toga, opting instead for a sarong-slash-towel wraparound effect. He looked around. They might have been standing on a sheet of black glass, under a starless night sky, except he could see Charlie, and Charlie could see him, so technically it wasn't dark. When he rubbed his eyes and looked again, he could see that they were inside a large stone chamber, lit with bronze oil lamps that jutted from the wall and threw long shadows up to a high, pointed ceiling. Across one wall and plane of the ceiling stretched the elongated shadow of a dog's head with long, pointed ears. Minty searched but couldn't see the dog that was casting the shadow. Yet there it was, a shadow 30 feet tall and still reaching only halfway to the apex of the ceiling.
I'm going to guess the underworld, said Minty Fresh.
You've been here before?
I had it described to me once, said Minty Fresh, and you look like your old self.
Charlie was his non-Mike Sullivan self, dressed in one of his Savile Row houndstooth suits.
Oakland? Asked Charlie. Not Oakland,
came a voice that echoed through the chamber. A circle of torches appeared. In its center, a tall, dog-headed man in an Egyptian kilt stood by a stone table on which stood a gold balance scale. In front of the table was a stone pit, perhaps 5 meters across. Something down there was growling and snarling.
"You know who I am," said the dog man.
"I do," said Minty Fresh. "Anubis, a man I knew, came here once, met you, told me about you."
"He was my brother's avatar on Earth. You are mine."
Anubis crouched, leaned forward, opened his eyes wide. The irises glowed deep gold.
"The eyes," said Charlie. "Of course."
Minty Fresh looked at Charlie.
"Of course? This all makes sense to you?"
"Sure," Charlie said. He inched forward until he could see into the pit. 30 feet below, a creature the size of a hippo circled the floor, with the body of a lion and the jaws of a crocodile. The floor of the pit was littered with bleached human bones. Charlie could make out skulls here and there in the orange light of the oil lamps. He backed away from the edge until he stood next to Minty again. Maybe not.
"You will go back," said Anubis. "You will be my avatar on Earth, and you will put things in order again. Do you understand?"
"I'm not good at taking orders," said Minty Fresh.
The dog-headed god seemed disturbed at the answer.
"You are not afraid, then?"
"Of what? I'm dead already, aren't I?"
"You are," said Anubis.
"Then no, I'm not afraid."
"Good. And you?"
Anubis nodded to Charlie.
"I'm fine," said Charlie. "Dogs love me."
Minty Fresh's gaze fell on Charlie like it had fallen off a table.
"Really?"
"Sorry." Charlie looked at his shoes.
"The weapons of men will not help you. Your enemies are of the realm of the dead. You cannot kill them. You shall have my gifts to meet your adversary," said Anubis. "Defeat him. Restore balance. Order. You are mine, and I am you. Now return."
"That is totally not helpful," said Charlie.
"Why are you even here?" said Minty Fresh.
"He must keep them from desecrating your body until you return to it. Away with you," said the dog-headed god.
The torches faded, the blackness returned, and once again they were standing as if they were in empty space at the end of the universe. Nothing but the two of them and the faint barking of hounds. And then Charlie was in the waiting room, Audrey standing over him.
"Are you okay?"
"Fine," he said. "I'm fine, fainted or something. How long was I out?" Audrey looked at Rivera, then shrugged.
"About 8 seconds, I guess."
Seemed longer. Charlie looked at the doctor.
"No autopsy."
The doctor seemed surprised. This was not the reaction he was accustomed to getting from people who had just received the news of the passing of a loved one.
"In cases of a crime," said the doctor, "it's the law."
"No autopsy," Charlie said to Rivera. "No embalming, no autopsy. It's important." Rivera said,
"Doctor, if we could hold off on the autopsy, I'd appreciate it."
The doctor nodded. "It will be up to the coroner after I sign off," said the doctor.
"I'll take care of it," said Rivera.
"I'm very sorry," said the doctor. He turned and went back through the doors. Once the doctor was gone, Charlie went to Lily.
"Hey,"
he whispered in her ear. Lily's mother looked up. Lily nodded to her that it was okay to let this stranger close.
"Kid, come here,"
Charlie said. He put his arm around Lily's shoulder and walked her away from her mother, away from the others.
"He told me to go to work," Lily said.
"Those were his last words. Go to work, Dark."
"Yeah, that's the thing," Charlie whispered. "You probably need to go to work."
"Fuck you, Asher. I'm grief-stricken, and I'm not even being overly dramatic." He didn't want to tell her that with the black eye makeup smeared down her cheeks like a sad clown, she was overly dramatic without saying a word. But in her hour of grief, he let it go.
"Yeah, I know, and I know that's a first, because you need to stay busy and keep your mind off of this. And when I tell you this next thing, you can't overreact. Promise me."
Lily looked at him with the familiar, "could you be any more annoying" look that she reserved for him, and he knew he could plunge on.
"Promise?" "Okay, fine, I promise. What?"
"He's not dead." She stared. Just stared. Stunned.
He's coming back, Charlie said. Don't scream.
She didn't move. She stopped breathing, then started again, in short, halting gasps.
I don't know when, but soon. I just saw him in the underworld. There's a god called Anubis. Asher, if you are fucking with me, I'm not, really, I'm not.
Now she was catching her breath. She leaned in.
He told me once that an Indian guy in Montana told him he was, like, the chosen of Anubis. That's why he has golden eyes.
Yeah, apparently that's true. She put her fingers to her lips as if she were holding in a laugh and bounced on her toes in a circle like an overjoyed little girl.
You're going to need to stop that.
Right, she said, stopping that. Sorry.
Now you're going to have to figure out what to tell your mom that I just told you that made you do that.
No problem. I'll tell her that you said the last thing he said to you was that he only regretted never telling me that I was right about everything.
He would never say that. She never met him.
Fine. Now look sadder and get your mom to take you to work. You're our only contact with the ghosts on the bridge. You need to be on the crisis line.
And we need her out of here so I can tell the others. I'll call your cell when I know more.
Okay. I'm going to hug you now, Asher.
Okay. It's not a real hug. It's theater. I'm faking it.
Right. Me too, said Charlie.
Lily and her mother had only been gone seconds when Charlie's phone buzzed. Jane. He answered.
He took Sophie, Cassie said. He just came in the door and took her. We couldn't do anything. We tried.
An electric chill surged through his body.
Who? The black guy in yellow. The one she talked about hurting Mrs. Korjeff.
Where's Jane?
She's right here. He did something to her. She ran at him, and he just put out his hand, and she dropped.
She's coming too, woozy, but she seems okay.
You called the police?
Yes, they're on their way. I'm still on the other phone with 911.
Charlie heard her talking to someone, describing the man in yellow.
Was he driving? On foot?
I don't know, Charlie. I couldn't move. He just looked at me, and I couldn't move. Sophie kept yelling for him to put her down. Called him Dookie Face. She wasn't screaming. Afraid screaming. She was yelling. Angry yelling. I'm so sorry. We should have been gone by now.
Tell the police everything, Charlie said. I'll be there as soon as I can. 10 minutes, maybe. Rivera and Audrey stood behind him, waiting for instructions, having read the situation from his end of the conversation.
We have to go, he said to Rivera. Audrey, can you stay with Minty Fresh's body? Don't leave him for even a second. You have to be there when he comes back.
He held out her car keys.
What?
Audrey asked, taking the car keys by reflex.
He's coming back. I don't know when, but stay with him.
Tell them whatever you have to.
I would do it, but I have to go.
Go, she said. Go, go, go.
She kissed him and pushed him toward the door. She pushed Rivera after Charlie.
Call me when you know anything.
You too, said Rivera. And if they give you any trouble,
go. I've got this. Go.
Rivera ran after Charlie.
Crisis Center, this is Lily. What's your name?
Her screen showed the call was coming from one of the hardwired lines on the bridge. Her heart leapt.
Lily, it's Mike.
Holy fuck! Do you have any idea what's going on?
And once again, everyone in the call center turned to look at her.
I mean, hello, Mike. How can I help?
This call may be recorded, she said, letting him know why she was being formal.
But only on my side, so you should feel safe to say whatever you'd like.
Okay, said Mike. I thought you should know there's someone here at the bridge, and all the ghosts are riled up. It's like a storm here. Not that you could see, but here, in my world.
I was going to tell you that I think we found that thief you were looking for.
Lily was trying to figure out how her side of the conversation might sound on the recording. Incoherent was fine. She could claim she was responding to someone who was suffering from delusions.